for the invitation, for organizing this wonderful meeting. I believe it was probably a lot of work, and we'll all work hard to make it worth your while. I'm going to talk about MetaWave clocks. The idea that as soon as I have a particle of mass m, I have a clock that goes back to de Broglie's MetaWave hypothesis. It's not just any clock, it's a clock that is particularly well suited for probing fundamental laws of physics because it can reach extreme resolution for small variations of the proper time measured along the path of the particle. But since this is the first talk of the session, and actually I'm honored to give that, I would like to introduce a very personal view of the field. So what are possible experimental signatures for quantum gravity? And I have here an energy scale, and the energy scale has a huge gap here. Here at the Planck energy, gravity, the electroweak force, and the strong force are supposedly unified in one underlying theory, which we don't know yet, which is, of course, consistent and comprehensive, because by definition, this theory is supposed to describe the entire universe as we know it, and also the facts that we don't know yet. At any experimentally accessible energy scale, gravity is already a separate force, whereas the electroweak and the strong force are unified, and then at even lower energy scales, they are split up in the strong, the weak, and the electromagnetic interaction. These theories, this regime is described by effective theories. In the view of quantum gravity, even the standard model of particle physics is an effective low energy limit of that theory. But the experimental search of quantum gravity, at least the part that I'm familiar with, operates from the insight that the standard model of particle physics may not be 100% accurate and comprehensive, but that tiny residual effects of the underlying theory might be found in experiment of extreme precision. So the idea here is that we cannot operate at the energy scale of the fundamental theory, but we can look for suppressed effects. And what are these suppressed effects? Well, because the interactions are already split up in the experimentally accessible energy range, the experiments that address the gravitational part and the electromagnetic and so forth part are a little different. So on the gravitational side, we might look for violations of the Einstein equivalence principle. For example, we might perform tests of the gravitational redshift of clocks, or test the universality of free fall of massive test particles. Instruments used for these experiments are clock comparisons, putting a clock here and on a tower, for example, torsion balances performed with enormous precision, for example, by the group of Eric Adelberger, and atom interferometers. At the non-gravitational sector of the standard model, one might look for Lorentz violation. For example, non-conventional limiting velocities, the idea that some particles have a faster c than others. Anomalous dispersion would be another signature, and experiments that have been performed consist of astrophysics observations such as gamma ray bursts, accelerator physics where you have fast moving particle in an accelerator, and again, clock comparisons. Clocks feature prominently on this slide because they can be realized to very high precision. And then there are, so these are kind of constant effects. They don't vary in space and time, or at least the experimental signature is not a variation in space and time. And here are less conventional effects, for example, decoherence in interferometers as induced by quantum noise due to the supposed granularity of space-time, searches for fifth and so forth forces, and these are again performed by interferometers, by nanomechanics, actually. This is a subject that is very new, and I'll have a small comment about that in the end, or tests of Newton's 1 over R law. And I think we'll hear about all these tests in this workshop. Whereas the underlying theory is unique, there's just one, and nature has chosen it. It's not up to us to choose, the effective low energy theory. Since the underlying theory is not known, everybody is free to choose their own favorite effective low energy theory. The one that's most well proven is the standard model. It has been tested experimentally very often and has been found to agree to any experiment performed so far, at least as far as I know. Now we're looking for a framework that goes beyond the standard model, and there's an important parameter in testing fundamental laws of physics. It's called the craziness. The craziness is, in experimental terms, how many assumptions of the standard model do I need to break before I have a signal? My personal taste, and this is a matter of taste, is to work in the low craziness region, or craziness of one. And that's why my favorite effective theory is called the standard model extension, has been developed by Alan Kosteletsky et al. And he has worked out the consequences of Lorentz violation and violation of the equivalence principle for a large number of tests, together with many collaborators, some of which are here. This is really an enormous body of work, and for me as an experimentalist, the existence of such a framework is a blessing, because we can't work out the signatures of all our experiments in any framework, so we're really glad that some people have done that for us. There are experiments in the, so these are just the data tables, right? Here are limits on the photon sector. There is, no, this was the matter sector for protons, electrons, and neutrons. Here's the photon sector, neutrinos. Here's the gravity sector, electrons, and so on. So this is an enormous body of work. But as I say, the fundamental theory is not up to us to choose, but the choice of the SME as the framework is a matter of personal taste. I will usually use it for this talk. My talk is going to focus mostly on the gravity sector. We are going to talk about testing the gravity sector using atom interferometry. Why testing gravity in particular? Well, it doesn't fit with the other interactions of nature, as is well known. It's described by the theory of general relativity, which, in contrast to the other interaction, is described by the dynamics of space-time rather than the dynamics of quantum fields. It is a nonlinear theory. The existence of a gravitational field means there is mass. The field itself is massive and causes small gravity, and this nonlinearity is another aspect that sets it apart from the other field theories. It cannot be quantized so far. There's many promising approaches, but there's none that is universally agreed upon to be the correct way of doing it. And the idea of why it tests general relativity is because the low energy limit of quantum gravity might be Lorentz violating. That's the idea here. And these Lorentz violations manifest themselves as violations of the equivalence principle in the gravity sector. Let's start this discussion of atom interferometry. And it is actually good to go back to the dawn of quantum mechanics in order to understand these experiments from an intuitive perspective. We take the idea of this gentleman as laid out in his thesis in 1924. He said, well, he looked at what his colleague Einstein had just told him, and that was E equals mc squared. And he also looked at what his other colleague Planck had told him. Planck said E is h times nu. And at this time, this was groundbreaking new research. People didn't know what this really means. Does this hold for any energy? Does this hold for any mass? Does it hold for any frequency? Or does it just hold maybe for the photons in black body radiation, the way Planck postulated it? De Broglie didn't know it either, but he did what any good scientist has to do. He said, okay, let's take these ideas completely serious. Let's suppose they are universally valid, and let's see what that means. In particular, it means that I'm allowed to put an equal sign between these two equations and to postulate that a particle of mass m is associated with an oscillating phenomenon of a frequency nu, given by this equation. And he went on taking it completely serious, and he said, what happens if the particle moves? And already at this stage, there's a contradiction, because if I have a moving particle, what would happen to its frequency? Well, a moving oscillator is time dilated, and so you would expect that nu gets transformed into this one, which is a slightly lower frequency. This is just time dilation, right? The other argument that you could make is, well, the moving particle has higher energy and therefore higher mass, and so you would expect the frequency to go up. What are we going to do with these two contradictory predictions? Well, de Broglie realized that if I have a moving oscillating process, this is a wave, and a wave has a phase velocity and a group velocity. And by choosing an appropriate phase velocity, he was able to get these two seemingly contradictory pictures to agree. He has to postulate a certain relationship between phase and group velocity, a relation that is learned by students nowadays as momentum is h bar k. Okay, the underlying physics of that, however, is the matter wave frequency mc square over h and that its properties under Lorentz transformations. This is, of course, not new. The striking thing is that de Broglie did know only special relativity. Had he known general relativity as well, he would have been able to include it here and would have been able to derive the Schrödinger equation, which would then be known as the de Broglie equation. How does this work? Well, this is the part we already did. A particle is an oscillating phenomenon at this frequency. I shall call it the Compton frequency because it's C over the Compton wavelength, okay? And it is Lorentz transformed. When I'm moving, the frequency goes down as measured by an observer at rest. If I move the particle higher, well, then it's subject to the gravitational redshift, and it would be shifted according to this equation by a factor delta potential over c square. And general relativity, of course, unifies these two expressions into this one, which contains the metric that encodes the gravitational potentials as function of where I am and the four velocity. When I'm doing this, I would insert this expression in the place of the Lorentz gamma factor here and would then be able to describe matter wave oscillations in a gravitational field. They would fall just as light is deflected in a medium with a varying refractive index, as seen here in this Fata Morgana in Finland. Here's the oil tanker. Waves that propagate in an anisotropic medium where the wave number depends on where I am get deflected, and so do matter waves fall under gravity because they are gravitationally redshifted. All this can be shown to be equivalent to the Schrödinger equation in the low field limit. What am I going to do? I'm going to take this frequency, it's time dilated, and generalize to the general relativistic expression, which is written here. The action of a point particle in GR is mc times the proper time. I perform a expansion of the square root for slowly moving objects in weak gravitational fields and compute an infinitesimal path integral and show that this requires that the Schrödinger equation holds, where here's the gravitational potential encoded by the H naught naught element of the metric, and here's gravitomagnetism. All this could have been known in 1924 had de Broglie known general relativity. It was done instead by Feynman in 1948. He, of course, didn't start from GR. This already shows you that there's not going to be anything new in this talk. It could all have been known to these gentlemen. But there's a pleasure in viewing things from a new perspective, because It helps your intuition, and that indeed helps you to create ideas. So let's look at this, what it means for atom interferometry. Here's a light interferometer. There's a source of photons, a lamp or a laser. There's a beam splitter that sends the waves this way or that way. And the probability of detecting a photon here at the output is given by the phase difference acquired by the electromagnetic waves on the two paths, which depends on the path length difference. For matter wave, it looks more or less the same. There's a source of matter wave. In our case, it's a magneto-optical trap of atoms. There's a beam splitter for matter waves, which can send the particle either along this path or along that path. There are mirrors for matter waves and a detector. The probability that the atom gets detected here, again, is given by the phase difference of the matter waves between the two paths. How does the source of matter wave look like? Well, this is a picture from the lab when the vacuum chamber is here. So what we do is we assemble about 10 to 6 atoms in a magneto-optical trap located here. And then we use radiation pressure from lasers to shoot them up so that they go on a 1.5 meter tall free-fall trajectory in this vacuum chamber, which means that for about 1 second, the atoms realize freely falling test particles to a very high degree of accuracy, because atoms that interact with rest gas in the chamber are lost. They get kicked out by the high kinetic energy of those hot rest gas atoms. Magnetic fields are very well shielded, and atoms are very simple systems. They have very few degrees of freedom, which means they can interact with the environment, but only in very specific ways that are under the experimenter's control. In this talk, I'm going to use two different types of atom interferometers. The first one is called Mach-Zehnder. Here is time and here is height. So the atom is on its way up in the atomic fountain, and at a time t naught, we fire a laser pulse at the atom. Okay, so atom is going up, photon arrives. The photon is absorbed by the atom, which kicks the atom up and transfers the atom into a different internal quantum state. But at the same time, we fire a photon from the top, and this photon stimulates the atom to emit the photon it has just absorbed back down. So the atom goes back to the ground state and gets yet another kick up. By tuning the laser intensity, we can make sure that this process happens with a probability of 50%, and the atom is now in a superposition of two quantum states that separate vertically. Firing the laser two more times creates two trajectories that interfere here at the time of the last pulse, and then the atom can either come out here or come out here. And the probability that it comes out, for example, at the upper arm is given by the cosine square of the phase difference accumulated by the matter waves on the two paths. How do I calculate the phase difference? Well, I solve the Schrödinger equation for the problem. We are deeply in the semi-classical limit because the action of the particles along these paths is way larger than h bar. This is good because it gives us a big signal. So we are allowed to use the Feynman path integral method in a simplified manner. In the limit that the action is much larger than h bar, the path integral reduces to an ordinary integral over the classical trajectory. And this gives us this result. The phase difference is given by the wave number of the photons, k, the acceleration of free fall, g, and the time between the pulses, t square. It's actually a sum of two terms, which will be important later. The first one is the term I just mentioned, the difference of the phase of the matter waves arising from the free evolution. The second term, delta phi laser, is because whenever the atom absorbs a photon, the phase of the photon is added to the matter wave and subtracted for stimulated emission. The sum of all these terms is summarized here in the delta phi laser. So this is an instrument that I can use to measure little g, for example. The second type of interferometer is called a Ramsey-Bourdais interferometer, and the chief difference is that now one interferometer arm is always at rest, and the other moves up, turns around, and moves down. I might call that the twin paradox interferometer, because going back to our de Broglie picture of viewing things, I can calculate the phase of this interferometer by simply looking at the time dilation of the matter wave frequency according to this equation. I can, of course, also use the WKB or the path integral method and arrive at the same result. This result is given by 2 times the kinetic energy over h bar times t. So this last term is the action from here to here, and then a similar term occurs here again. That's why the factor of 2. This kinetic energy is endowed to the atom by the photons, so it turns out to be h bar k squared over 2m. And manipulating this expression a bit, I can insert the k, the wave number, as the laser frequency over c, and insert the Compton frequency to get this very simple expression, omega laser squared over omega Compton. Here are interference fringes that have been measured by Keng Yao Chang in his PhD thesis. They are, as far as I know, still the most accurate gravimeter data points ever measured by an atom interferometer. So each point here comes from a single experimental run, and fitting this entire fringe determines gravity to one part in a billion. Now, this is a workshop on quantum gravity, and so I don't want to spend too much time on experimental tricks, but I don't want to skip this one. The problem in matter wave interferometers is that the momentum of one visible photon is low, and the atom moves by just 3.5 millimeters per second when it scatters one photon. To get more sensitivity, we need a larger distance between the interferometer arms, and that can be done by scattering more photons. And this is the technical achievement of this group. We have run matter wave interferometers where we scatter up to 24 photons at once. Now, the kinetic energy of the atom sometimes determines the signal, and it goes like the momentum square, so it goes like the photon momentum square. Here's a comparison. The black line is measured data, and the red is a sine wave fit. And these have been measured by scattering 18 photons with the atoms. And here's a comparison to simulated data of what happens if I scatter just 2 photons. And so you see that the resolution goes up quite a lot. And this will be the basis for many of the experiments that I will show you. There's a problem with contrast decay due to vibrations that can be solved by running 2 interferometers at once. So you see here the Ramsey-Bourdais interferometer that I've just shown. This time gravity is switched on, so this is in free fall. And here's an inverted interferometer. Now, if I plot the fringes of this interferometer, they're a sine wave, relative to the fringes of that interferometer, it's again a sine wave, they're going to form an ellipse. The common mode phase of the 2 interferometers is going to determine which point on the particular ellipse I create, and the differential mode phase determines the shape of the ellipse. It can be anything from a straight line to a circle to a straight line in the other direction. The nice thing is that I can draw the ellipses even when I'm unable to draw the fringes of the individual interferometer. So here is the fringe of interferometer 1, and it doesn't look at all like a sine wave because the sensitivity to vibrations is so high that the fluctuations exceed one full cycle. And this one is also, there's no fringe visible here, but if I plot this on the y-axis and this on the x-axis, get this ellipse, the shape I can fit, and from that I can determine the differential phase. One last neat effect was the Coriolis force of Earth's rotation. So if I fire the laser at time t naught, it points vertical and splits the atom into two populations that separate vertically. But 150 milliseconds later, at the time of the second pulse, the laser has rotated with Earth, and that means the two atomic populations are going to miss each other. Okay. To counteract this problem, we've installed a rotating mirror at the top of the vacuum chamber, and this is a plot of the contrast as function of rotation rate, and you see that the contrast peaks for one particular rotation rate of the mirror, which integrates turns out to be the Earth's rotation rate projected onto the plane at Berkeley. This was the last effect this effect actually was pointed out to us by an intern from Austria who came for 2 months. He said, what about the Coriolis force? And so we installed this mirror, and all of a sudden we could see interferences out to 250 milliseconds, whereas before 100 milliseconds was the best. So all these little technical advances help us to gain more and more sensitivity. And right now, this is the most sensitive atom interferometer in the world, but I don't expect this record to hold for a long time because other groups are making very rapid progress. So this is a rapidly developing field. Okay, now what can I do with that? A first example would be measuring the fine structure constant. I can write the fine structure constant in this way. It's, here's the Rydberg constant, here's the ratio of the Planck constant and the cesium mass. And if we recall the phase in the Ramsey-Bourdais interferometer, there was a term h bar k square over 2m. Now the laser wave number is known, and so this thing becomes a measurement of h over m, m cesium, and then I combine it with the cesium to electron mass ratio, and I get the fine structure constant. Now all these values are known to about 10 digits except for h over m. That's why we want to measure that to 10 digits as well. That could be compared, that could then be used to calculate, so the measured alpha could be used to calculate the electron's gyromagnetic anomaly, which is calculated in quantum electrodynamics, and here are all these contributions to the QED theory of G minus 2. And you see, this is the accuracy of current measurements, and this is the previous accuracy of all alpha measurements, which has so far improved to this level. The agreement of the predicted G minus 2 and the measured G minus 2 is one of the most accurately verified predictions in all of the standard model of physics. So this is a very significant accomplishment that physicists have made over the past decades. But I'm going to go back to our problem of what can we say about quantum gravity? What can we say about quantum mechanics and gravity? And the question I pose here is, what is nature's elementary clock? So the question here is, okay, I have this frequency mc square over h, which I can write on paper, of course, and has the dimension of a frequency. But is it really just something on paper, or does it have some measurable consequences? There are other examples for things I can write but can't measure. The wave function, for example, can be written on paper, but it cannot be measured. How is it with this frequency? Does it have all the measurable consequences of other oscillators? In which case it would be great, because this frequency is extremely high. It's 10 to 25 hertz for cesium atoms, so that can be used to test space-time to extremely high precision, right? Or is it just something that occurs on paper and does not really feature in any measurable quantity? So let's see. We're going to look at, can we use that to test general relativity's redshift, and going to talk about the discussion that has been triggered by these ideas. We're going to analyze the experiment in my favorite effective low energy theory. We're going to talk about a gravitational Aharonov-Bohm effect, which we have not yet measured, and the Compton clock, which is suitable for measuring the length of this talk based on this frequency. All right, MatterWave redshift test. I'm going to skip the history of redshift tests in the interest of time. Just want to mention the Gravity Probe A experiment. I think these are Bob Vasseau and James Levine, and James will correct me if I confuse them. Holding the actual hydrogen maser, which was sent to an altitude of 10,000 kilometers atop a Scout rocket in 1976. And when this was published in 1980, it was the highest precision test of the gravitational redshift ever performed, with an accuracy of 70 parts per million. Now, what do atom interferometers bring to the table here? Well, this is the Mach-Zehnder interferometer, and I can calculate the phase shift by solving the Schrödinger equation or using the path integral formalism. In the path integral formalism, I take the phase of the matter wave to be given by the action. The action is the integral of the Lagrangian, and it's written here. Nothing stops me from using a relativistic action, even though it might be overkill for our slowly moving particles. This relativistic action, approximated for slowly moving particles, has one term, which is given, which is the gravitational redshift. It's the gravitational potential difference between the two trajectories, and the difference in time dilation because of the differential motion of the two trajectories. And then here's the laser atom interaction phase. Now I can calculate the overall phase, and this splitting up of the phase into three terms is a statement that holds in my particular formalism, but it doesn't hold in every formalism. So this splitting up of the phase in three parts is in that sense not physical. The only thing that is physical is the total phase, because that's measurable. But what you see here, or what you can at least motivate using this equation, is we know the light atom interaction phase. It depends on the laser K vector and where the atom is. This is known. We know the time dilation. Time dilation has been tested in many an experiment before, so we can assume that this has the conventional value. And that means that we know these two terms, and we know the overall phase from the measurement. That means we know the size of this phase. And in that sense, we're testing the gravitational redshift with these two atoms. The analysis proceeds in exactly the same way as with GPA, where you have a redshift term and one term due to the motion. Okay. Now, this has sparked a lot of debate. And why is that? That's because what we have here, the cesium interferometer, is indeed 10,000 times better than the previous space experiment, and it's still much better than proposed space experiments. So people have asked all sorts of questions about this, and I summarized them as good as I can on this slide. First criticism was, am I really testing general relativity in the same way as I would test them with clocks? Or is it that the effect of the gravitational redshift would always cancel the effect of the time dilation, even if general relativity is not valid? You see, you have these two terms, right? What if any violation of GR would increase one, but also increase the other, so that the overall effect always cancels out? In order to address this point, we will have to set up a model of physics in the low energy limit and calculate what happens. So we're going to address this by the SME analysis. The second criticism was that the Compton frequency, this one, is unphysical. The atom should not be viewed as a clock. It should be viewed as simply a rock, a test particle that moves in response to gravity, but doesn't have any other interesting features. We're going to address this point by showing that omega Compton gets redshifted even in situations where there's no force on the atom. That's an Aharonov-Bohm effect of gravity. And finally, the thing was, and this is not really a technical point, this is more an intuitive point, the atom is no real clock because it cannot be used, for example, like any other atomic clock could be used to measure the length of this talk. I cannot use that with this, do that with this frequency. And we have an experiment that actually does. let's look at the first point. The standard model extension is not just any model to parameterize violations of GR. It is fully comprehensive in the sense that it includes the entire standard model of particle physics plus Lorentz violation. It has been extended to include the effects of general relativity, so I can use it to model departures from general relativity. But in all other aspects, it's a conservative model. Energy and momentum are still conserved. I'm still free to choose any coordinate system I like in order to analyze physics. So the Lorentz violation here means that the outcome of an experiment might depend on the frame of reference in which it is performed. This is not the case in standard physics. But the outcome of the experiment does not depend on the frame of reference of the observer. And this is important, because otherwise two observers would not agree on the laws of physics. So this is very important that we preserve coordinate independence in this way.
Sorry, that's as long as the frames are inertial, right?
Yes, of course. If I'm non-inertial, then I get gravity, that's right. But I am still free. General relativity is coordinate independent in the sense that, well, inertial and non-inertial frames are not equivalent, but I'm still free to choose whatever coordinates I like. The SME also gives rise to a well-defined low-energy quantum field theory. So this goes back to my initial mentioning of the craziness. This is a model of craziness one. We assume that Lorentz invariance is broken, but nothing else.
At which scale is violated?
Excuse me?
At which scale is violated in Lorentz symmetry?
At which scale?
Yeah.
At all scales. So the original SMEs has been published. The first paper they published maybe 15 years ago considered only the simplest case of energy-independent effects. So they would be constant in space and time, and they would not depend on the energy of the experiments at which I observe them. And then they went on and switched on the higher mass dimension operators, which give rise to energy-dependent terms. But all these, so these effects are constant. They are not fluctuating. That means even at very large scales, Lorentz symmetry is violated here.
But are you basically, feature now breaking Lorentz invariance only in the matter sector, because you're saying include all the effects of general relativity, and basically you are taking the full package of different variants. But for example, if you want to implement the Lorentz breaking also in the gravitational sector, you would have a reduction of your deformative group, like in your relationship.
Right. It actually, so the full standard model extension actually contains breaking of general of Lorentz invariance and general relativity too. For example, gravity might depend, not the gravitational attraction between two objects might depend on the direction of the distance vector between them. So the original version of this theory did not include gravity. That has been added on top of it later. In most of this talk, I will be concerned with the terms that already arise at this scale.
So just to understand, so what is the model of gravity you're taking in? Is as a preferred foliation, is even more complicated than that, in the sense that you have not just a preferred foliation like Lorava, but you are putting some sort of other field. And I think I'm confused about the kind of gravitational sector you're putting in your theory. What you're constraining, because now you're telling me you're taking Lorentz violation in the gravitational sector.
This is not my work, this is Alan Kosteletsky's work, right, and of his co-workers, so I shouldn't take any credit for that. There are two effects. So the first types of terms I introduce into the Lagrangians of, for example, a free electron. It turns, so there's two terms in particular we're going to talk about. One is called A and one is called C. Now it turns out that, so these terms can be moved to other sectors by coordinate redefinitions, and in particular can remove the A terms by going into a particular coordinate frame. But if I do that and now switch on gravity, then it turns out this A term is going to depend on the location in curved space-time, because the way I eliminated it from the equations of motion in flat space-time was a coordinate transform. So even the terms that I introduce in the purely flat space-time model will have gravitational effects because they are variable as soon as I have curved space-time, simply because I require consistency of my coordinate transforms. So in that sense, even the flat space-time parameters give rise to equivalence principle violations. The second type of terms are included explicitly in the gravitational sector. Now, I've made a mistake. I shouldn't say explicitly, because Kostoletsky has found, and I'm just citing this, I cannot explain it, that explicit Lorentz violation is not compatible with some fundamental properties of space-time, but spontaneous breaking of Lorentz symmetry in the gravitational sector is possible. And this gives rise to additional terms that are included only in the gravitational sector. So I'm not sure I've answered your question, but this is as far as my expertise goes. Okay. What I'm going to do, though, is to take this standard model extension, as Kostoletsky and co-workers have created it, and apply it to my experiment. We go into an isotropic subset, so I already assume that all the effects of Lorentz violation that are measurable in flat space-time, speed of light, isotropy, ticking rates of different clocks that I rotate, and so on, I assume that all these terms that can be measured in flat space-time have already been measured and found to be zero. And this is largely true if you look at the data tables. Of the remaining terms, there are two flavors. One is called C. It is CPT even. That means it has the same effects for matter and antimatter. And one is called A, which is CPT odd. Each of these two terms exists for the proton, neutron, and electron. So I treat protons and neutrons as elementary particles here, which is fine because I operate at very low energy scales. And they enter the effective action of a particle in gravity in this way. So here's the metric. The tensor C is added to the metric, and the vector A is added to the entire thing in this way. Now, for my experiment, it is sufficient to consider only the 0, 0 component of C and only the 0 component of A. That's because my particles don't move very fast. This finally gives rise to this effective action of my particle with the C here and the A here. And these C's and A's are weighted averages of the C's and A's according to the proton, neutron, and electron number in my interferometer. Gee, just 5 minutes, I have to speed up. Okay, with this action, we have to obtain the trajectories of the atoms by applying the principle of least action, calculate the phase, and turns out the measured phase is the old one, kgt square plus 1 plus beta, and beta contains the A's and C's. And we have calculated that for a number of experiments. The classic Pound-Rapke experiment measures this linear combination of parameters. The cesium interferometer measures that. So in the interest of time, here's just the bottom line. The limits before the atom interferometer on all these terms were at the level of 100 or tens of parts per million, and they all improved more or less 10 times thanks to the atom interferometer. Why are the limits at part per million level versus the measurement is at the part per billion level? That's because I need at least 5 experiments to determine 5 parameters from the measurement. And these experiments measure linear combinations that are relatively similar to each other. In disentangling these limits, I lose 2 or 3 orders of magnitude of accuracy simply because the experiment measure different linear combinations, but they are not that different. Bottom line, I measure these parameters, so the atom interferometer is a great test of general relativity. We've also tested the terms that you asked about, the ones that arise just in gravity, and cause gravity to be anisotropic, and this put limits on these gravity sector components at a part per billion level, and that is complemented by lunar laser ranging experiments that have even higher accuracy for some but not all of these parameters. Are they clocks? If they are clocks, then they should get redshifted by gravitational potential, even if there is no gravitational force. Whereas if they are just massive particles that move in response to gravity, they should do nothing if there's no acceleration or free fall. Well, I can create a gravitational potential that looks like this with two saddle points here and here. If I put a rock here, it doesn't move because g is zero. But if I put a clock here and a clock here, they're going to tick at different rates. And this can be realized with cold atoms by using two spherical test masses. They are on the order of a few centimeters. Put atoms here and interfere them, and I'm going to see a phase shift of 0.3 radians per second. We haven't done that experiment, but we will do it. And if it turns out to yield the expected effect, then atoms are clocks and not rocks. The effect can be derived from the Schrödinger equation as well, as must be the case because we've shown initially that the two are equal. Now I want to show you the matter wave clock. So how to make a clock that ticks at 10 to 25 hertz divided by a huge number, so I can use it to measure the length of this talk. Here's the Ramsey-Bordet interferometer. I'm going to remind you that its phase was given by a measured frequency omega recoil times t, and omega recoil is the laser frequency squared over the Compton frequency. Now, this is almost what I want. I want a signal of, let's say, one pulse per second based only on the Compton frequency, but this also contains the laser frequency. In order to get that, I need a second equation, which is omega laser is n times the measured frequency, and I can obtain that equation by using a frequency comb. So here's how it works. The atom interferometer measures the phase, and the phase was... the phase was omega laser square over omega Compton. This is the recoil frequency, right? The second equation is omega laser is the measured frequency times the number n. So I measure the frequency and I multiply it by a large number of 4 billions using the frequency comb, stabilize the laser to that frequency so that these equations hold simultaneously. And from that, I get the measured frequency as the Compton frequency over n squared. Try it. It's simple algebra. Now, the measured frequency turns out to be 100 kilohertz, so it can be conveniently used as a clock. We have run it for 6 hours at an accuracy of 4 parts per billion. And the application would be, since 4 parts per billion is not a great accuracy for a clock, but now we have a clock based on mass. We can turn it around and build a mass standard based on time. I will have to skip this because of time constraints. Just going to sum up. Okay, atom interferometers used for measuring alpha. I didn't have time to detect gravitational waves and build inertial sensors. A part per billion redshift test with de Broglie waves. We have bounds on the SME parameters for all EEP violations at 0.1 part per million level. Why is it all of a sudden 10 times better? That's because we switched on the nuclear binding energy in our more recent analysis. And I've presented the Compton clock. And thank you very much for your attention.
Talk, and we have now 10 minutes for questions, discussion.
One more question. When you consider this Ramsey for the experiment, you have again this fluorescence signal as a function of time. So if you Fourier transform this, then you will get immediately the first frequency, which is that's what you expect theoretically. So if you extend, the question is, if you extend this time measurement very long, because, I mean, the peak of the frequency in the Fourier spectrum goes, the signal to noise is proportional to the square root of the time. Can you increase the sensitivity of your measurement? I don't know if it's,
so,
if you get my point.
I'll try, and you correct me if I didn't get it. So the sensitivity depends on how large is the phase and what's the signal to noise. The phase is of a size, well, this frequency times the time separation between the two pulses. And also, I can put my factor of n squared here. Let's do it here. I can put my factor of n squared here, where this is the number of photons interacting with the atom. So to get better sensitivity, I can try to increase this. I can try to decrease the mass. So that would be a case for trying it with hydrogen, or in the extreme case, with electrons. I would actually love to do it with electrons, and there's some ways of doing that. If I could do it with electrons, that would finally enable us, we can measure the gravitational redshift of the electron clock, and that would finally be a clean test of the equivalence principle for electrons. You remember there's the old Fairbank and Wittebond paper, which is hard to interpret because of the electrostatic interaction with the, of the electron with the walls. And finally, I can increase the time.
Exactly.
This time is now up to 0.25 seconds. Why is it not longer? It's because the contrast that we measure goes down when we increase the time for reasons that we don't understand. So I believe that it's due to a lot of technical influences. The last technical influence that we removed was the Coriolis effect that allowed us to go from 0.1 second to 0.25. I'm waiting for the next intern to tell me how to go from 0.25 to even larger. So this is hard to answer right now. If I knew the answer, we would remove that effect, right? So how good can this ever become? I would say if our setup with no improvements at all would reach the shot noise limit, the quantum projection noise limit, it would be about 100 times better, which would put it at 10 to minus 11. If I could increase the momentum transfer to 20 h bar k, I get another factor of 4. If I could reduce the mass from 133 cesium to lithium, that would give me overall another factor of 100. That would put me at the 10 to minus 13 level. And now if I would like to go completely crazy, I would say, let's use electrons. That increases the recoil frequency by another factor of 2,000, and then we're in the 10 to minus 16 or 17 region. But this is, of course, music of the future.
You occasionally use the two words, quantum gravity. Strictly speaking, you're discussing experimental properties of quantum particles and waves in classical gravitational field.
This is true.
So from my point of view, this isn't quantum gravity.
This is true. I actually sent this email when I was invited to give this talk. I said, thank you very much for the invitation. It will be my pleasure. What I have to offer is quantum and gravity, but not in the same word. This is true. I hope, however, that these experiments can be used to test the laws of gravity and of other physics. And in those frameworks of the standard model extension, which are believed to be the low energy limit of quantum gravity, we are really looking for violations of the accepted physical laws of fundamental symmetries, and these might be due to quantum gravity.
I have I like the craziness factor, because it has an important tradition in science, actually, to keep it low. I mean, we know that has what paid off often. It's just easier to compute the factor afterwards. For example, you could give a craziness factor of 1 to adding a right-handed neutrino to the standard model, and you just gave us, say, craziness factor of one for having a preferred frame for the laws of physics, because some amount of, and really this is the this is not easy to say that those two number ones are comparable.
That is true.
I think it's best to use it as a guiding principle. I mean, we know from the history of physics that to keep the craziness factor law has paid off. Non-zero has paid off, but not too much bigger than one. But also to feel that we have a sense of what is crazier before we know where we're going is very difficult. And I mean, we might discover over the years, for example, that Weber's preferred frame was the craziest possible idea. Single, you know, it could be. This is something. So something that we count as one now could be counted as 10 in itself in 50 years. It's not simply that you can say it in one line, because one hypothesis is so many things.
It is true. This is not a well-defined quantity. I was using it in a joking manner to emphasize the fact that we want to look for breakdowns of one aspect of the standard model, but not many aspects at the same time. But in the history of physics, sometimes theories with a craziness of much larger than two have worked out. I mean, what was the craziness of introducing quantum mechanics?
still very high.
Still very high. So there's no reason to restrict yourself to that.
Okay, we have time for one more question. If not, I will take two. You mentioned that the phase difference that you separated in phase coming from the interaction of the atoms with the photons and the phase that the mm-hmm. atoms acquire during the path could be divided in different ways depending on how you do the analysis. Mm-hmm. My question is the following. Isn't the division really unambiguous due to the fact that one scales with time the atoms spends in free fall while the other one is constant? I mean, you could separate the two phases by doing several experiments where the free fall is different, but the interaction of the atoms with the photons is kept the same.
So what I meant when I said it is ambiguous is I've analyzed the experiment in the rest frame of the laboratory where the laser is at rest.
Yeah.
If I would, for example, go to a frame in which the laser, in which the atom is at rest and the laser is accelerating upwards, then the laser phase would change its value and the other two terms would also change their value. This is what I meant. But the overall phase is of course the same.
But you can separate, you can do several experiments, right? And analyze them also in this fashion.
That's
and they should separate.
That's right.
In principle, you should be able to measure the two phases separately.
And this
and if
is
that's
actually,
the case, then it's not an issue.
This is
I mean,
actually,
the analysis should be, yes, the individual analysis would be complicated, but it will not mix the two phases.
Yeah, and this is a very good point that I actually want to do in this Aharonov-Bohm experiment, because here I can measure the gravitational redshift separately by removing the test masses and adding them. And I could measure the time dilation separately by moving the atoms around without the test masses. And this is important because that would show that in all respects, the matter wave acts like a clock. It redshifts like a clock when there's, even when there's no force, it time dilates like a clock when it moves and so on. So yeah, I think this is a very important point. If this experiment is right now being set up, we're maybe have accomplished a third of the setting up phase, but I'm very excited by the prospect of trying that. Okay.
Okay, so we have a break now. Thank you. Let's thank the speaker once again.